Welcome to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with directors and artists in the performing arts. I'm your host, Joseph Miller. You'd be hard-pressed to find any blarney when Italian-born pianist Alessio Bax joins the Santa Barbara Chamber Orchestra this Tuesday night, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. Unless you count the craft beer tasting event afterwards, open to subscribers. The first half of the concert, however, belongs to conductor Heichiro Oyama and the orchestra, and will celebrate music from or about the British Isles, appropriately, including works by Frank Bridge, Friedrich Delius, as well as Felix Mendelssohn's deeply affecting The Hebrides. But the second half has nothing to do with St. Paddy, and everything to do with Bax, and the fulfillment of his dream to perform Brahms with the SB Chamber Orchestra. According to Bax, Brahms' first piano concerto reveals a subtle level of new meaning when played with the intimacy of a chamber ensemble instead of the larger orchestration which is customary. The International Piano Star and 2009 Avery Fisher Career Grant recipient has garnered kudos in Santa Barbara in recent years, principally due to repeated appearances with the SB Chamber Orchestra. Late last year, UCSB Arts and Lectures brought Bax to the Granada stage with violinist Joshua Bell for a memorable performance that included a masterful articulation of Sergei Prokofiev's Sonata No. 1 for violin and piano. Bax spoke with me from his home in New York earlier this month. We talked about his forthcoming album of solo piano works by Russian composers and his thoughts on the recording process itself and how he goes about choosing when to record a piece. We also talked about the four-hand repertory, and that's music written for two people sharing one piano. Bax and his wife, pianist Lucille Chung, together form one of the leading piano duos on the world stage today, and in 2013 released an album featuring themes from Stravinsky's ballet Petrushka, as well as waltzes by Brahms and tangos by Piazzolla. Bax spoke to me also of his commitment to the education of the next generation of pianists, and the Achucaro Foundation that he and Lucille Chung direct. Finally, he spoke to me about the important influence of his foremost piano teacher, Joaquin Achucaro, the Spanish pianist Bax studied with from the age of 10, and also of a masterclass with pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim, an event that impressed him so deeply that the memory continues to guide him today.
I'm so glad that we could have the opportunity to talk.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
I'm afraid to ask, where are you located right now?
I'm in New York now.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Yesterday from Tallahassee.
Okay.
So I'm here for a few days.
Did you were in Tallahassee for a performance?
Yes, at a recital the day before yesterday.
Okay.
And I'm off to Baltimore on Friday, I believe. Yeah.
I don't know how you keep the busy international schedule that you do.
Well, that's the nature of it, I guess.
But your wife is also a busy pianist too, so you two must not see very much of each other.
We do play together quite a bit as well, so we try to travel together. Next week, she's playing a concert with the Dallas Symphony, and I'll be going with her. And we have a 10-month-old daughter now. So.
Oh, you do! Congratulations!
Yes, thank you. So we're all traveling together as much as we can.
Right. Oh, that's fantastic. So you'll be coming to Santa Barbara on
yes.
on St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Mm. So you'll be wearing a green tuxedo.
Of course, I'm planning to. No, don't say that.
I'm waiting to hear how Brahms Piano Concerto Number 1 is connected with the Irish spirit.
Oh, you'll have to ask Maestro Yama for that. I think the program came together in different angles. I mean, the Brahms is something that, you know, I've played so much repertoire with over the years with the Santa Barbara Chamber Orchestra and with Oyama. And it's always been so rewarding and so interesting for me. And Brahms, it's normally considered much more symphonic. You know, you usually need a much bigger orchestra but it's such an incredibly intimate and beautiful chamber work as well. So I am really, really excited. I've been asking him, we should really do Brahms over the years. And finally, he decided, okay, let's do Brahms. And then it happened that the date of the concert, the only one that we could all do was that. And I wonder how he made the whole program around it. But I'm sure there is a reason. It's very, as you know, it's very deep.
Well,
but it's such an iconic work, and I'm really excited because very often it's perceived that as piano versus orchestra kind of concerto. You know, there are big orchestra, big forces, and big writing on the piano, and kind of this constant almost fight between the piano and the orchestra. But as I said, it's such a beautiful and collaborative work. Mm-hmm. The piano is really part of a symphony. In this work, and you need the kind of musicianship that this orchestra has, and collaboration. Really, everyone's listening to each other and reacting on the spot, and I'm really, really excited to bring it to a much more intimate level than usual.
Is it possible to say that in all the times you've played the Piano Concerto Number 1, have you played it with a group this small?
I'm not sure. I might have done many years ago, but it was one of the first few times, you know, and that I played it. I was on tour with both Brahms Concerti with the Chamber Orchestra in Italy. But now, I mean, that I've played it with many larger orchestras and really all over. And I'm coming back from a different side. So it's kind of coming full circle. Mm. And I feel that I've lived with this piece long enough to know it much better than I did, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the collaboration with the musicians will be much, much more enjoyable, I think, for everyone.
Your relationship with Maestro Oyama, how many years back does that go?
Yeah, we were at the Chamber Music Festival together, and we played a couple of pieces together, him as a violist.
Yeah,
he wasn't a conductor yet, and so we met each other's chamber musicians, and we kind of felt so comfortable playing together that he invited me soon after. I believe the year after, we already discussed then what to play in Santa Barbara, mm-hmm. and then I don't think I've missed a year yet.
Yeah.
So it's been great, and at the beginning of this year. He started a new chamber music festival in Japan, in a town called Akita, and that then we got to play him as a violist again, together again for the first time since we first met, and it was really a lot of fun to come full circle that way, because
wow.
Now I know him as a musician so in such a deeper way because of his conducting.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. I mean, it felt like we've played all our lives together, you know.
Oh. You were here just 5 months ago with
Joshua Bell. Yes, of course.
Yeah, and that was wonderful. That's one of the nice things about Santa Barbara. We have so many active classical music organizations that we get repeat visits.
I know, I mean, it's such a pleasure to be any excuse to come to Santa Barbara. I'll take it. But that I almost forgot because we were on a really, really crazy schedule. I mean, I think I spent 2 hours in a hotel room in Santa Barbara, and I went to the concert. You know, we drove from LA and then arrived 2 hours before the concert and then played the concert and left right after the concert. So that was my quickest visit to Santa Barbara.
Mm.
Beautiful weather. I looked, saw the ocean. The drive was fantastic, and then I had to leave.
I took a young man with me. It was a beautiful concert, especially the Prokofiev. I took a young man with me who doesn't listen, you know, doesn't know very much about classical music. And he told me afterwards that it was only the second classical music concert he's ever gone to.
Wow.
So he can truthfully say that 50% of all his live music experiences have been Alessio Bax.
Oh my God. Hope he wasn't disappointed. Hope he wasn't the last one.
No, he was very open to it. He was very open
That's
to
great.
It and really enjoyed it a lot.
You're listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with directors and artists in the performing arts. This is Joseph Miller, and my guest this week is pianist Alessio Bax, who will be performing with the Santa Barbara Chamber Orchestra under the direction of Hajiro Oyama this Tuesday night, March 17th.
I was thinking about Prokofiev, and I was thinking about you're currently performing Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, and your connection with Stravinsky, and you're going to be recording, or you have recorded, or you're in the midst of an album of solo Russian piano pieces.
Oh yeah, I just recorded it last month. Yeah.
Wow.
Mussorgsky Pictures, an exhibition, Scriabin Third Sonata, pretty crazy transcription of Night on the Bald Mountain, and a couple of short pieces by Scriabin as well. So that will be out, I think, September, October this year.
Is there something about the artistic soul of Russia that speaks to you in particular, or is that a ridiculous generalization?
Yeah, I mean, but I love Russian music and love Rachmaninoff, and I love everything Russian. But, I mean, we have so much great repertoire that I try not to limit myself and really love so much of it, most of it, I have to say. But after a few years, I see myself going back to a few of the same composers and Russian composers, especially ones connected with the piano, like Rachmaninoff. They've always been there for me. That and late Romantics, Brahms and late Beethoven. And somehow I always revert to them. Then I keep adding more and more to this circle of friends and favorites, let's say. So I think I've, over the years, because I keep coming back to them, I just learn more and more about them. So the knowledge grows deeper somehow. But if I have to speak about, you know, which one I like more, I really can't say.
Yeah.
I mean, I just played the Ravel Concerto last week in New Orleans and the G major.
Mm.
And that's something that I don't play that often. I mean, I played only a few times. And I have to say that week, I mean, there was nothing that I would have loved more than playing the piece.
Mm.
And I never thought of me as someone that, you know, really loves French music more than anything else. But at that time, when you're so deeply engrossed into such great music, there's no space for anything else somehow.
Yeah.
And so that's constant. But then, you know, if I look back, you're right. I mean, I always kind of go back I'm always in the company with a few composers, no matter how many others I'm working on.
You seem to maybe have a bit of an inner composer in you, or maybe a lot, for all I know. You have, when you do the Piazzolla pieces with Lucille, I understand that you both improvise while you're playing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've been doing your own arrangements of pieces?
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I can't sit down and write music. I mean, that's something really, I cannot even conceive how people would do that. I mean, the most I've done is writing cadenzas for Mozart concerti, but that's using material that's not my own, you know, starting off from Mozart's own material. And then the transcriptions actually came out more of as a necessity. There's a few pieces like Rachmaninoff Vocalise, for example, that I really loved, and I couldn't find a transcription that was close enough to the original. Because very often transcriptions for piano are elaboration and paraphrases of the original. So there's a lot added to it, which is wonderful. But in my case, I wanted really to recreate the sound world and the feelings of the original work, whether it was for orchestra or voice. And when I couldn't find something, I just took the original score and kind of translated it into for my own two hands to make it sound as close as possible to the original. So I wouldn't call that composing, but it's more about knowing the instrument and knowing, understanding how to produce an ideal sound from it, you know.
And what about the improvisations on Piazzolla?
Well, that's just fun. Yeah, I mean, they're not two times. I mean, there are a few things that are kind of the same every time we played, but most of it is never the same. I mean, there's no way we or anybody else could write those improvisations down, because they really change all the time. But there's another element to it, which is very interesting. It's the trust that you know, we're both sharing the same keyboard. So we kind of have to trust that we're not going to step on each other's keys when we don't know which ones they are. And that's very exciting in a way. And most of the time, there are no accidents happening. So it's kind of a dare a bit. And the more we play, the more daring it becomes. And then I hope just one day it's just going to implode and just, you know, wreck. But it's a lot of fun.
It does look very daring. I mean, in the videos, you can reach between her hands, or you can reach on the other side of her body. And
yeah, I mean, there are things like that have to be rehearsed, and you know, I can't just do that without telling her, and not suffer any consequences from you know, hands clashing into each other and so on. But most of it, I mean, all the flourishes and sometimes harmonies, and of course the structure is always the same. It's very much like what jazz musicians do. I mean, when you get three or four or even more jazz musicians, and you have a very solid base of what the number they're going to do is like, what's going to be like, then everything else is really made up on the spot, and it's incredible how that works out.
You and Lucille do these four-hand pieces. It's a very special relationship, and a very special thing for us listeners, because you have an unusual relationship, because it's such a personal relationship too. And you've said something interesting, that the traditional music for four hands is sort of it was written as parlor music, for music among friends, and therefore it has a heart quality to it.
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. I mean, there were not mostly commissions, there was anything commercial about it. And when you look at music by, especially Romantic period, going back from Mozart on, and he wrote pieces to play with his sister, and then Schubert for his soirees, and then Brahms and Schumann, and some of the purest, most authentic and honest music. Not that the rest is not, but it's incredibly intimate.
Yeah.
I mean, just the idea of playing, you know, I do a lot of chamber music, but I don't know many people I would like to play four hands with, because it's such intimate and tricky and difficult and very deep relationship. You're actually sharing the same instrument. And
right.
Imagine doing that on any other instrument.
That's right. It wouldn't work on the clarinet.
Yeah, no.
it's a gimmick on the cello.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point. That's true. The pieces were not, they weren't commissioned pieces. They weren't, and they were, you know, yeah. Anyway, that's.
Yeah, I mean, think of the Schubert pieces, Fantasy and then Grand Duo, and then it's really incredible, incredible music. There's nothing to prove to it, and it's just coming from the soul somehow.
Right. How do you decide to record something? How do you know when it's the right time?
Well, I've been very lucky to work with my label now for a few years and the same team for actually 7 recordings now, I think. And I have, like every musician, I suppose, I have a list of, a secret list of pieces that I would love to record. And that I love to play, and I think they really speak to me, that I've been performing or I want to perform, and I'm still able to go through that list. So there's usually one piece that I really want to record, and then I center the album around it somehow.
Mm.
So it started first with my first album on Warner Classics. It was Baroque Reflections, and that was the Rachmaninoff Corelli variations, and then it became a whole Baroque-themed, not Baroque pieces, but Baroque-themed album. And then Bach, and then Brahms, and so on. So I'm still somehow going through that list.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a few more. And then, as I grow, there are more. The list gets longer as well.
Right.
And I've been blessed to work with a label that has said yes to every whim of mine. So I'm very, very happy.
Jonathan Biss has written about kind of the psychological minefield of recording, because he's undertaken to do the whole corpus of the Beethoven sonatas. And just the whole issue that you're imprinting a moment in time, a particular moment in time, and with everything that brought you to that moment, and yet you're making something that's supposed to be for all time. Do you ever think about that contrast? Do you ever think, you'll look back in a few years and say, I wouldn't interpret it that way now?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I already do. I mean, the day after I finished a recording already, I just played the program now with Pictures and Exhibition in Scriabin Third, which I recorded last month. And every day I was practicing, I kept thinking, oh, I wish I would have thought of this. But that's the nature of music. It gets better with time. There's no way that someone, I mean, it would be very sad if it was the opposite. I played this, but it's not as good as the recording.
Yeah.
That'd be a very depressing life.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I work up to, I try. Unfortunately, it used to be that you would tour a piece for a long time and then have a recording, and then records would sell in the old times. But now it's the opposite. I mean, you need to record something and then tour it so you can sell records.
Mm.
And I've managed to find a balance between the two things, for which I would maybe tour half a program, then record it, and then finish the tour. So both sides, my artistic side and I suppose the record selling side is also happy. But there's a process. I mean, I love the process of recording, but always knowing that you're just going to give the best of what you can give at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But then, the day after the record comes out, and there are things that I'm not going to be happy with. I've noticed that after a few years, though, when I listen back, there are things I'm not happy with, but there are also things that kind of surprised me that I could do, back then. Or so I think it all balances out. In a way, the most the biggest responsibility for me is not to put something on the record, but actually to play it live in front of an audience that's paid a ticket, that's sitting there. And where things could go wrong, and so if I'm able to do a certain program in front of live people, then you should be able to do it on the record as well. That's my philosophy.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really healthy, and sounds like it's an accurate view of what's involved.
And I actually really enjoy the process. I mean, the team I work with, it's really fantastic, and I think they get the best out of me. And there's always a very happy and healthy and creative process in the recording. Because in a way, if something goes wrong, you can always go back and do it again, which you cannot do in the concert. And I feel the same kind of pressure to myself when I perform in front of a live audience. I mean, I'm not thinking, if it doesn't go well, it's okay, they'll be gone by the time I finish the concert. Unfortunately, it's not the way it works. So you can see how, comfortable the recording process can be compared to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with directors and artists in the performing arts. This is Joseph Miller, and my guest this week is pianist Alessio Bax, who will be performing with the Santa Barbara Chamber Orchestra under the direction of Hajiro Oyama this Tuesday night, March 17th.
You studied with Spanish pianist Joaquin Achucaro, and Lucille did too, I guess. And together,
yes, after we met. Yeah.
Together you have you direct the Joaquin Achucaro Foundation centered in Dallas. Is that right?
Yes, we're the artistic directors. That's a wonderful foundation that has many aspects to it. It's to help with the legacy of Joaquin Achucaro, who's still at 82 is touring and concertizing and playing every repertoire there could be. It's really an inspiration. Mostly it's to help young pianists with performance opportunities. I mean, they came to us and said, how can we help young pianists? What's the best, it could be scholarship money, and we do that as well, master classes. But as being on stage, I think the most important way to help a young pianist is giving opportunities to play. Because no matter how much they practice, how much they're taught, how well they're taught, there's no better, there's no substitute to stage time, I think, in learning and experience. And it's so hard for young musicians to find opportunities to play.
Mm-hmm.
And to be heard, and we thought that was the most important thing. So we started a few partnerships around the world now to give an opportunity for young musicians to perform.
Okay, so it's not just like a festival in Dallas, but you're actually supporting venues all over.
Yes, within Washington D.C. and abroad in Spain quite a bit, and. And it's ever expanding. I mean, using our connections and others coming from the world. I mean, Joaquin Achucaro and his wife Emma are very involved in it, and we kind of guide the president of the manager of this foundation, Janet Kafka, their name in Dallas, who is the brainchild of. I mean, who gave the first idea, and. Put all the resources together and then raise the money to do it, and so we kind of guide the artistic side of that.
Okay.
And with the Achucaros, still very, very involved, which is a privilege. I mean, I've met Joaquin Achucaro when I was 10 years old, and he's really my spiritual and musical father.
Anyway. Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Is it possible for you to articulate how his, in some particular way, how his influence has affected your playing or your approach to playing?
In every way, I have to say, because I met him when I was so young, and he's an active performing musician. And to me, that was essential. I mean, he really taught me what happens on stage. And he knows the piano as an instrument better than any other pianist I've ever met, how the pedal works, how to get sound, a beautiful sound from the piano, not just through your ears, but actually through your body, what to do to get a good sound out of any piano and things like this. And he's really an eternal student himself. I mean, he would change now at this age, he would change completely fingerings if he finds that something is more interesting. And wow. The first one in Dallas that, you know, gets up before six and starts practicing, and it's really an inspiration in many ways. I think he loves performing, of course, but he loves the practicing and the working part more than anything else.
He lives with the piano.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh. I mean, more than anybody else I've ever met. Oh. And he's a wonderful person and very balanced in spite of that. So, mm-hmm. So that's really a role model, I have to say, in many ways, as a musician and as a person too.
Right. You did a master class with Daniel Barenboim.
Yes.
That was
yes.
recorded, and I have a huge respect for Maestro Barenboim. I also feel like he has such a solid presence. I would think it would be so easy to be intimidated by him. I think if I was a wind player in one of his orchestras, I probably couldn't catch my breath if he looked at me.
Oh, he has the stare too.
Yeah.
No, it's amazing because he's he really has 7-8 different brains working at the same time. But when he looks at you or is talking to you, for a very short time you have 100% of his attention, which is very intimidating.
Yeah.
And when you play, it's the same thing. I didn't know him before this recording that we did, and you know, just sat there and played a fugue of Hammerklavier with him sitting, you know, at arm's reach, and five cameras, kind of spinning around me. So it was very intimidating, but I have to say, I mean, to this day, there are things from that class that still inspire me.
Mm-hmm.
And I find very few moments in my musical life that keep generating inspiration year after year. And that's so rewarding. I mean, I keep thinking about something he said, or I keep thinking about something I heard in a performance, or that still inspire me to this day.
That's lovely.
Not just on that particular piece, but on many things. And that's, you know, that's a life lesson. Mm-hmm. It's a real definition of a life lesson, I think.
Right.
You've been listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with directors and artists in the performing arts. For more information about this program, to listen to archives, or to communicate with me, Joseph Miller, visit www.therightjoe.com. That's TheWriteJoe.com. For information and tickets to the Santa Barbara Chamber Orchestra's performance on Tuesday night, March 17th, at the Libero Theater, featuring guest pianist Alessio Bax, visit the Santa Barbara Chamber Orchestra online or call 805-966-2441.